Great.
Okay.
One second. You usually want me to send it. Okay.
You will not start until I tell you. I'm not lying.
Yeah, I know. We're just discussing before we start. Okay. So, I mean, are there any, in terms of topics or anything you want to run through or?
I'm open to questions. I remain.
So your voice will go out otherwise.
Guardedly optimistic from a number of different points of view.
Okay.
I don't know if it's relevant. I don't know how much this is focused on, you know, Palestinian-Israeli religious issues. One of the things that most concerns me now are actually environmental issues, because there are plans for massive building both within and worse around Jerusalem that I'm opposed to. They include building mm-hmm. areas that were supposed to be reserved as one is a forest area and other green areas.
Right.
That's something that I'm concerned about, especially because the mayor and I disagree on that, whereas right. another things I feel otherwise. So I don't know how relevant and or important that is to the audience.
I don't know.
Here.
I think it's fine to give a few sentences to.
Okay.
If I had to predict, that might not be the top issue. That, yeah. But I guess okay. a lot of, I mean, these are progressive Jews, so that's like, this is, progressives care about that issue. So
yeah.
it's very likely that, that they will. Uh-huh. Just in terms of the hierarchy, I don't know where it stands.
Yeah, okay. I don't know how to turn off all these.
Danny, can you hear us, Danny?
Can you hear me now?
Oh, great.
Yeah, all right, welcome.
Okay. Eureka!
Eureka.
All right.
Okay.
Okay. So we're live, everyone.
Okay. Okay.
So let's get this going. All
welcome,
right.
Danny.
Hello to everyone in the U.S., Israel, Palestine, and other places in the world. Welcome to this latest installment of Conversations with Israel and Palestine, hosted by Partners for Progressive Israel. Conversations with Israel and Palestine is a series of informational webinars that bring voices from Israel and Palestine to an American audience, providing an important link between progressives in the U.S. and in the Middle East. My name is Jacob Magid. I'm the settlements correspondent for the Times of Israel, and over the next 60 minutes, I'll be serving as your discussion moderator. Before we get started, let me note that Partners for Progressives Progressive Israel is an American non-for-profit 501c3 organization dedicated to the achievement of a durable and just peace between Israel and its neighbors, and believes in the need to ensure civil rights, equality, and social justice for all of Israel's inhabitants. Partners seeks to deepen American Jews' understanding of Israel's complexities in order to enhance their ability to advocate for a progressive Israeli future. Okay, now let me introduce our two panelists for today. We'll start with Dr. Laura Wharton of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. She's also, obviously, more importantly, I would say, is a member of Jerusalem City Council on behalf of Meretz, the left, since 2008. She's also the founder of the Cooperative Transportation Association of Jerusalem, which provides transportation service in the city on Shabbat when no public transportation is available. We also have attorney Danny Seidenman, founder, and director of the NGO Terrestrial Jerusalem, which tracks all developments in the city that could impact permanent status options, destabilize the situation, spark violence, or create humanitarian crisis. So thank you to the both of you for being here. Let me just add the discussion will go on for about 40 minutes. After which we'll be answering questions from the video audience, and I encourage you to type in your questions at any time. All you need to do is look at the bottom of your monitor for the icon that reads Q&A. You may need to touch your screen or run your mouse over it. Then click on the icon and type your question in the small box that appears. The webinar won't disappear or be disrupted. Please note that viewers' microphones are turned off and questions can only be asked when typed in this way. So let's get started. So I thought an interesting way that we could start this conversation with the two of you would be to just start with an open question that each of you can answer. I don't, maybe we'll start with Laura. About what people, we hear a lot about this notion of divided Jerusalem, a united Jerusalem. And I think for many people, it's kind of, it might be a little bit confusing. What does that really mean? Because if the city is currently united, why do we seem to still feel like there are, in a lot, there's a wall part of, through part of the city. But at the same time, Israel controls just about all of it. So maybe if you guys, each of you could just touch on what it, what you think it means when people talk about divided, a united city, a divided city, what is an ideal situation? Go ahead, Laura.
Okay, well, first of all, I'd say Jerusalem is definitely divided today, regardless of what the prime minister or anyone else says, in at least two senses. First of all, it's physically divided. And there's a wall that goes through part of it, not necessarily along the green line, not at all on the green line. But it's also divided in the sense that there are neighborhoods, Palestinian neighborhoods, that are very sorely neglected, in which Palestinians live who have no Israeli citizenship and are generally ignored and also underfunded. And there's another half of Jerusalem that is Israeli, in which Israelis live, and they live on a completely different standard of living, get different and better services. And that's why it's divided. However, I think Jerusalem is, I would say on the other hand, though, that Jerusalem is united in the sense, in only one sense, and that is that most Jerusalemites want Jerusalem to remain an open city. So I wouldn't even talk about it as divided or united. I would say both Palestinians, I think, want it to be an open city. They want access, certainly, to Haram al-Sharif, to the Temple Mount. They want to be able to have jobs and reach all parts of the cities, as do Israelis. So I think most Jerusalemites, if not all, or a large, a safe majority, want it to be an open city, but they don't want it or see it as united in that people live at different standards of living and also have different perspectives. They're divided in how they see the future of the city. And I'll just say in the last sentence, what I think should happen, what I hope will happen, what I expect will happen, is that Jerusalem, the sovereignty in Jerusalem will be redivided. But I do hope and expect that it will remain open and that there'll be access for all Jerusalemites to all parts of the city.
Thank you. Danny, do you want to pick up on that? Anything you'd like to add? Danny, can you hear me?
You're very garbled. Can you hear me?
A little patchy by me. Not so well.
I think we might be best going over for me to go to the phone. I will deprive you of the burdens of looking at me and we can speak more clearly, so if it's possible.
Okay, we can try that.
Or you can leave your picture on and pick up
the phone. Some of that.
Yeah, we're having a really hard time. You're pretty in it, coming in and out. So, hello?
Okay, give me a call and we'll talk by phone.
Okay, so Danny's having some technical difficulties. I can't really hear him right now. Hopefully he'll come back in a second. Laura, when you're talking a little bit about this notion of what you think it will look like, if you ask, I think looking at polling, the majority of Palestinians, the vast majority of Palestinians, I can say all, if you could argue, that want to see East Jerusalem as part of their future state. I think an equal amount of Israelis don't want to see what's considered a divided Jerusalem. And in general, that people might interpret it different ways, but even in the Labour Party, you won't find a leader nowadays that would say that they want to divide the city. So how do you reconcile these two very difficult, very polar opinions?
Well, I would start by saying something that I usually don't say, and that is that although I usually trust and believe in the, wisdom of the masses and so forth, I think in this case, most Israelis who talk about having a united Jerusalem and believing that Jerusalem should be united and not, be a capital of any other country don't really know what they're talking about, in the sense that I know from polls and personal experience, most Israelis and most Jerusalemites never go into East Jerusalem. Some of them may go into the old city, and maybe even into the Muslim quarter of the Old City, but they don't get into all the neighborhoods around it. As soon as we've done a number of polls of various types, and other people have done more serious versions, most Israelis and most Jerusalemites don't know where Sinwan is, don't know where Isawiya is, don't know where it is. And I think if we were to turn that half of Jerusalem or that part of Jerusalem tomorrow, or turn it over to the Palestinians, or if we had done it last night, most of them wouldn't even notice because they never go there in any case. So therefore, I think that when Israelis are asked, you know, if they want a united Jerusalem, you know, they would say yes, because they don't really know what it involves. I would tell them that, you know, Jerusalem will remain the capital of Israel forever, but not Isawiya, Tul Baher, and a bunch of other places, they would be fine with that. As for Palestinians, yes, I think the overwhelming number of Palestinians would prefer to have self-government, self-control, and eventually be the capital of or part of Palestine when such a thing exists. But for the time being, I think, we have to understand that what they want, what they feel is dissatisfaction and anger with the occupation by Israel, but they don't really have an alternative, unfortunately.
Okay, so when you, going a little bit, staying on topic, but a little bit going back to the first question, when we talk about when your assertion that it is divided in most ways than not, what does that look like on the ground in terms of maybe resources or voting various, what does that mean?
Well, I'll start with maybe the end, which is, I think, a good example of how tied to Israel Palestinians in East Jerusalem feel. In the last elections, not even 2% of the Palestinians turned out to vote, whereas the Israeli side, it's something about 65%, I think.
And how many of them have the right to vote?
I'm talking about 2% of those that have the right to vote.
Okay, and then in terms of what does it look like in terms of how many are able to vote versus are not able to vote?
Well, I'm talking about the municipal elections.
Ah, okay, the municipal elections.
Elections, all permanent residents of Jerusalem, which is what Palestinians who live in Jerusalem are called, can vote. So, you know, there are 350,000 approximately Palestinians in East Jerusalem, and of that number, of that whole population, they said less than 2% turned out to vote.
And then in terms of the national elections, what does that look like, the numbers?
Well, the national elections, a very, very small percentage a few thousand, I think, only can vote, and the numbers that vote in the election were very low. I actually haven't seen the number that vote in the national elections, but more than 95% of the Palestinians in East Jerusalem are Palestinians. That is, they don't have Israeli citizenship. There are, you know, Arab Israelis who live in Jerusalem, also not a huge number, and there are a small number of Palestinians who live in East Jerusalem who were permanent residents and took on citizenship, but they're really a very minimal number. So I think that says a lot about how they feel. And the way it looks on the ground is you go in West Jerusalem and you see, you know, a nice modern city. You go into East Jerusalem and some of it looks like Gaza. I mean, some of it is really run down, poorly taken care of. It's looking, some parts look a lot better. Some parts look somewhat better, but there's a lot of terrible neglect, especially in the neighborhoods that are on the other side of the separation wall. And there are close to 100,000, that is almost a third of the Palestinians in East Jerusalem, live within the municipal borders, but on the far side of the separation border, and therefore they get very minimal services from the municipality. And there's also no overseeing in terms of building. The roads are in terrible shape, and a long list of other services that, you know, are really sub-quality, substandard.
Okay, so what I understand, obviously, the solution would be to be investing more in these in East Jerusalem, correct?
Mm-hmm, right.
So then, but how do you, on the one hand, invest more On the other, if you're saying that you want East Jerusalem to be eventually part of a Palestinian state, how do you prevent, when you invest in Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, the normalization of Israeli control of the area? Does that make sense?
I think what one has to do, and this is, among other things, what international law demands, is that Israel provide basic services. That means roads, that means schools, that means health services, a long list of things, you know, sanitation services that an occupying power, if you look in the Geneva conventions, is supposed to provide. Now, what Israel does in a lot of these neighborhoods beyond the separation wall and everything is collect taxes, occasionally send in demolition crews, and provide some minimal level of schooling, but very, very little. And what I think should be happening is, regardless of what the future brings, regardless of what arrangement is we'll come to at the end of the day, we are, you know, legally and morally, I think, obliged to guarantee a better level of services and to see that their lives are better and more equal with ours. I think also that more and more Israelis, and especially Jerusalemites, realizing that's what we have to do, among other things, because whatever happens, we're going to remain and I think if we do the minimal things that are required of us, our future together will look brighter, whether we're on the same side of an international border and living in the same country or not. I think we have to be good neighbors regardless. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Meaning, obviously, that there's an onus on the Israeli government here, but how does that onus look when we're talking about, a lot of the time, a growing movement amongst Palestinians who don't really want to be necessarily part of any sort of system? Meaning that if you go to a school in Nazareth, where you have Israeli Arabs who obviously citizens of the country that speak Hebrew and are able to get jobs in Israel. But in East Jerusalem, oftentimes you'll go to a school that's run by in East Jerusalem for the Palestinians, and it's run by the education curriculum is run by the Palestinian Authority, and they don't speak Hebrew. They're therefore oftentimes unable to get jobs. I know specifically statistics on women, they're just not able to get jobs in Israel because of their lack of Hebrew. I'm trying to understand this, like, on the one hand, obviously Israel has a responsibility, but on the other hand, it seems that there's not always a willingness from maybe certain Palestinians to want to be part of what's happening, of developing East Jerusalem.
Well, I think it's not, I mean, there are two very different things. One is there is a demand and a growing demand and expectation from Israel to provide basic services. And the other is a question of Israelization, as it's called, or how much they, you know, want to become Israeli or part of the thing. As far as the services, as I said, there's a growing demand and expectation. And I would say also that Israel is actually doing more and more to invest in East Jerusalem, sometimes not for the reasons I would like. And I could just say briefly, there's a strange kind of ironic meeting now between left and right, in that I think, for example, that Israel has to invest more in East Jerusalem because we have a moral and legal obligation to the Palestinians. People on the extreme right are more and more joining in with me, and we have very funny votes on the subject because they want to express or give expression, as they would say, to Israeli sovereignty. So they want to invest there to make it clear that Israel is the boss there. So that's one thing. About the providing services, but about the Israelization, I think unlike what's happening in other parts of Israel proper, where you have, you know, Israeli Arabs who are citizens who are more and more, you know, disgruntled, dissatisfied, disappointed with, you know, the inequality within Israel, in East Jerusalem, I think there's a growing number of Palestinians, and especially young Palestinians, who don't care about the politics. They want to learn Hebrew, they want to get jobs, and they don't want to be part of any kind of international conflict. They want to live their lives. So there is a growing demand in East Jerusalem for studying Hebrew. In fact, there's there are more and more efforts among Palestinian groups and in Palestinian neighborhoods to teach Hebrew, and there's also a growing willingness and interest in Jerusalem, in the municipality, to provide services and lessons. Actually, Israel in Jerusalem, in the municipality, just now, we've started a series of Hebrew lessons for city employees who were either employed in jobs in East Jerusalem where they didn't need Hebrew, or for various other reasons. So that's a service that the municipality is now providing for its workers that never existed before. So I would say that, you know, again, both things are a little bit different than what you might sound that, but what you might think that, I think in terms of services, there's a growing demand and agreement both among Palestinians and among Israelis that Israel has to do more to increase the standard of living there. And about Israeli, you know, Israelification or whatever, although there certainly is a lot of antagonism and BDS supporters and all kinds of things Palestinian, I think among the younger generation, there are more and more who are just practical. And if learning Hebrew will get them a job, they'll do it. And if, you know, they can get a better job or better paid in West Jerusalem than East Jerusalem, then they'll work in West Jerusalem. So there's a very real young pragmatism that I think is expressing itself.
Got it. Okay. So I think, Danny, can you hear me?
I can hear you. I'm sorry that I missed so much because I respectfully disagree with Laura so much. But I only picked up part of it.
Okay.
My take is slightly different, or more than slightly different. I would basically say Jerusalem is divided, and the division of Jerusalem derives from one thing, and that is you have two national collectives in Jerusalem, one of which is politically empowered, and the other Palestinian collective is permanently politically disempowered. We did not impose our citizenship on the Palestinians of East Jerusalem. We did not offer our citizenship. They don't want our citizenship. That, and when that is a permanent state, that is a state of occupation. The Palestinians are indeed pragmatic. I identify some of the things that Laura is pointing out, and I can only commend her for the efforts that she's making within the framework of the municipality to make Palestinian lives under occupation better. But that does not derogate in any way from the basic fact that Palestinians of East Jerusalem are not Israeli. They're not becoming Israeli. We've never treated them as Israeli. They've never viewed themselves as Israeli, and they are politically disempowered. Over the last, there was a 2-year period just recently, I stopped counting, in which I tracked the number of Palestinians, minors, who were detained in East Jerusalem. There was a 2-year period recently in which I was able to count the following, that Israel has detained more than 10% of the Palestinian boys between the ages of 12 and 18 in clashes with the police. And they're doing so because they perceive that they have no ability to shape their own lives. The Palestinians of East Jerusalem are indeed willing to adapt or accommodate as long as it does not require them to barter in their national identity. There was a huge debate going on several months ago. Will the Palestinians of East Jerusalem participate in the municipal elections? Many thought they would. I thought they would not. I was wrong. There was a surge in the participation. It went from 1 to 1.5% voter turnout. That's worse than Kansas, Dorothy. They did not participate, even though they pay a huge price for it, because they will not acknowledge that we are Israeli, or we will acquiesce to the legitimacy of Israeli rule. So Laura is correct. They will accept any entitlement in order to get by, as long as it does not require them to waive their national identity and oppose occupation. I have never, in the 27 years that I've been dealing with, sensed a greater sense of helplessness than I have among the Palestinians of East Jerusalem over the last 4 years. There is a sense that we are incapable of shaping our lives. We are treated by the leadership in Ramallah, as a vestigial organ. Drop Abu Mazen off at the Damascus Gate with a seeing eye dog and a licensed guide. He won't be able to find his way to Al-Aqsa 300 yards away. But the Israelis treat us as enemies. We have no ability to shape our lives. And the perception that I perceive in East Jerusalem, that in under Israeli rule, Israeli lives matter, Palestinian lives matter much less, and that cannot be ameliorated, it cannot be lubricated, it can only be ended, and it can only be ended by a political division of the city, and the prospects of that are nil. And
okay,
that is
okay,
generating an unprecedented hopelessness in East Jerusalem.
Okay, thank you very much, Danny. Just want to remind everyone that if you have any questions that you'd like us to address later on after the 40-minute discussion that we're having, please do so in the Q&A box on the bottom of your screen. What I thought might be interesting, and Laura and I were discussing this briefly before we hopped live, was where our panelists see the city in 10 years. Devoid of a political solution to the conflict that Danny might have been talking about, where is the city heading? Specifically, I'm thinking a little bit about when you have the fastest growing populations are ultra-Orthodox and Arab residents of the city. What does that kind of look like? I know, Laura, you mentioned a little bit of optimism that you're feeling about the future. Do you want to elaborate on that, or also just more specifically answer my question, whatever you prefer?
Okay, I just want to pick up on one thing that Danny said. I mean, I think there is definitely a feeling of hopelessness and frustration in East Jerusalem. We agree on that. We also agree that there is a great pragmatism amongst Palestinian Jerusalemites. I think another thing that's interesting to note about the recent history of what's been happening to Palestinians in East Jerusalem is when there's this whole crisis, I guess it was about a year ago, about what were called the magnometers for checking people that go up on the Temple Mount. The Israeli police decided to put up these metal detectors at the entrance Haram al-Sharif. And what ended up happening was there was a massive protest of Palestinian Jerusalemites, about, I don't know, 50,000 or something, went and prayed and basically made a carpet of protesters on the roads around the old city, and eventually succeeded in changing Israeli policy, and these metal detectors were removed. Why do I think that's important? Because in that case, the battle was basically on two fronts. It was both, and largely, of course, a protest against the Israeli policy and the attempt to regulate who went up to the Temple Mount. But it was also, to a certain extent, a sense of frustration, also a show of power of the Jerusalem Palestinians against the Palestinian Authority that didn't intervene and help them. And they did that on their own. And there was really, I think, some euphoria even in East Jerusalem when they won that battle. And it was also, and I think this is a wonderful development in East Jerusalem, it was a nonviolent battle. Sadly, tragically, a number of people were shot and injured by the Israeli service.
Yeah. Happened. I want to wrap you up. The question?
Okay, so that was one thing. But I think it's important to know when you try and understand what the spirit is there, there's a sense that there's a new identity of Jerusalem Palestinians. About how the city will look in 10 years, I am guardedly optimistic for a number of reasons. One is that, as I mentioned before, I think there's a growing realization among the Israeli right, together with the Israeli left, that the neglect of East Jerusalem is not just a moral problem, it's a real danger to the future of the city. So there has been an increase in the development of East Jerusalem. Another thing that makes me optimistic that I think will change, apart from the fact that I hope and expect there will be some improvement, is that there are more Palestinians, I think, who are finding ways to live in East Jerusalem and work and be part of Jerusalem as a whole, despite the fact that, and this I agree with Daniel, that they continue to feel Palestinian and not Israeli at all. But they're finding a modus vivendi, and I think that's a good thing, because although I do believe the city will be divided, there's certainly a sharp distinction between Palestinians who are not citizens and Israelis who are. The third thing I would just mention that we haven't touched on yet, but I think is important, in terms of religious and secular relations. On the one hand, things seem to be heating up. On the other hand, I think the middle section of religious Israelis who aren't ultra-Orthodox, who aren't extreme, but have more and more in common and more identify with the secular, I think are bringing the hope of settling a lot of those issues in a much less violent and confrontational way than they've had before.
Okay. Danny, I mean, where do you see the city in 10 years, given the
Much differently from Laura. I do agree with much of what Laura said about the events of July 2017, although I described the dynamic differently, but I won't get into that. Let me start with the macro, because Jerusalem is a major centerpiece of the macro. And I agree with Tamir Pardo, the former head of the Mossad, who said that Israel confronts only one existential challenge in this generation. It is not the Iranian nuclear capability. It is not 120,000 Hezbollah rockets. We can deal with that. They're dangerous, but we can deal with it. It is perpetual occupation. Israel will end occupation, or occupation will be the end of us. And what Tamir Pardo says in the macro, I say about Jerusalem. I am terribly pessimistic about Jerusalem's future over the next 10 years, because the only way that Jerusalem will turn into a viable city for Israelis and Palestinians is by ending occupation. And the prospect of that happening over the next several years is remote, if not impossible. I'm not sure I will live to see it. We're living in a period where there's a chasm between the politically impossible and the historically inevitable. Occupation of East Jerusalem can be in extremis ameliorated. Some of the manifestations of the extreme manifestations of occupation can be addressed. Laura does a wonderful job in the municipality of doing that. But at the end of the day, Israel rules East Jerusalem unwisely, unjustly, unfairly, not because we're more racist than others, there is racism, not because we're more stupid than others. We have no business ruling over them at all. And occupation cannot be reformed. It cannot be fixed. It cannot be lubricated. It cannot be repaired. It can only end. And that is not happening. And one last word. The occupation of East Jerusalem is not only destroying East Jerusalem, it is destroying West Jerusalem.
Okay, so again, but I'm interested in knowing what it will look like. Obviously, can you elaborate a little bit about what that means? What could get worse?
What that means is intercommunal warfare, a city that is becoming more impoverished, more, you know, they're mirror images of one another. Jerusalem is becoming less educated, more impoverished, more religiously extreme on both sides of the line. Young people in West Jerusalem flee to Tel Aviv. Young people in East Jerusalem flee to Ramallah. You see an increasing ascendancy of religious communities that weaponize religion. We will be a backwater. It will be something of a prop for Hezbollah, which is completely detached from the reality. Jerusalem is becoming an uneducated, impoverished backwater, which is unattractive except for people who see the myths of Jerusalem and not the reality. That's where we're heading in the foreseeable
future. It's funny because I thought you guys were both going to be on the same side of the political map, but it's good that you guys are both giving very, very different responses. No, it's good. I'm glad. What I thought go ahead.
No, I think we have similar analyses of the current situation. I think the question is what trajectory we're on. And as I said, there are aspects of the city about which I'm optimistic. And I understand that Danny is very decidedly pessimistic about just about everything.
Okay, so I think one issue that might particularly interest some of our listeners or viewers, specifically those in America, is this freezing of the so-called the COTEL deal, the Western Wall Agreement, meaning that there had been an agreement, status quo agreement made between Netanyahu's government a few years back and the American leaders abroad, kind of to formalize a new prayer space for non-Orthodox Jews to be able to pray at the Western Wall. Several months after that agreement was made, it was frozen due to pressure from the ultra-Orthodox parties in the Knesset. I'm interested in knowing, maybe most from you, Laura, where kind of this issue stands. Do we expect any changes? Right now it's a pretty insane situation going on in terms of whether or not we have a government. But go ahead.
Well, I'd say this, from afar, the situation does look very problematic because the government promised one thing and is doing another, and that could, you know, be yet another reason for a crisis. I don't know if that will be something that will be settled by whatever government we have after midnight tonight or not. I can say, however, that I was on a field trip with members of the city council who are on the regional planning committee, including ultra-Orthodox and religious. And I think I was the only secular representative there. There is agreement about what has to be done. There is a permit, an agreement about what the space would look like. I don't really think that there should be a problem. If you ask the Jerusalemites, you know, who are involved in the decision making. The question is what kind of a government we're going to have and how much, you know, the higher ranking people will interfere and create problems where there need not be any.
Thank you. Danny, anything you wanted to add on that?
Yes, I love Laura, but I find myself disagreeing with you again.
That's what makes it interesting.
Absolutely. We are entering one of the most dangerous periods in Israeli history as we speak. There is very little that Netanyahu will not do in order to remain prime minister under indictment. He is not only fighting for his political life, he's fighting to stay out of prison. And that means that he will do anything, or almost anything, I wouldn't say anything, in order to maintain his base, and his base are the ultra-Orthodox, which means as long as Netanyahu is around, hair will sprout on the palms of my hand before there will be an arrangement at the Kotel, as much as I would like to see that. I believe we are approaching the end of the Netanyahu era. I'm not sure if it'll take months or years. Once Netanyahu is gone, then I will agree with Laura. There are all sorts of possibilities. Add to that that Netanyahu is the Republican senator from Israel. He does not do conservative and reform Jews because they tend to be democratic. They are simply not part of his calculus.
All right, that's our pessimistic correspondent, Danny Seidemann.
That's my optimistic version.
There
of
you
it.
Go. All right, next time I refer to you, I'll use optimistic. I think let's see how we're doing on time. Another reminder: those who have questions, please feel free to place them in the question box. I think we'll have one more question before from myself before we. Head towards to the I think what we'll do is if either of you have something a final word that you'd like to say, go ahead right now. Laurel, is there anything you wanted to add?
Well, I'd just say, I mean, there is no question that there are extremists of all kinds in Jerusalem. There are extreme ultra-Orthodox Jews. There are extreme right-wingers. There are, you know, who want to, you know, raise the Temple Mount and build a third temple. There are extremists who support the Hamas, any number of them. I think the question is, will the more moderate people from all these communities be able to come together and either control or limit the control or limit the effects that these extremists have? Most Jerusalemites, as I believe, most people feel, would like to keep Jerusalem calm. They don't want to see the city go up in flames. This has always been true, even during wars, even in the last war, Tzuk Eitan, you know, when there were demonstrations all over, most Jerusalemites were making the greatest efforts to try to keep things calm. And I think that could continue to happen. Of course, as I said, the extremists are there and they could have an effect. I really hope, and I call it every possible, in every possible circumstance, at every occasion, for people to remember there are moderates on the other side. And if we can hold things together, you know, we can keep the city together. Because really, the you know, it would be very easy to make the city go up in flames tomorrow. Occasionally, there are people that try to do that. I believe the overwhelming majority of Jerusalemites don't want that to happen. And I just hope that we can resist the temptation to, you know, of a backlash against the extremists on the other side, whatever that other side is.
Thank you. I probably should have had you say it at the very end. So Danny, I'm going to give you another chance at the very end, because I realize it's more appropriate for you guys to sum things up at the end. I do want to go to questions from our audience.
Okay.
And we have one from, let's see, where did I find one that I thought was very interesting? An anonymous attendee asked, is there a concern that this year is March of the Flags, and that is the Jerusalem Day, which is on which day? Next week on Sunday?
Mm-hmm.
On Sunday, thank you. It's just a march of oftentimes young members of the National Religious Camp that dance through all of the city and also make a stop through the Muslim quarter of the old city. And the anonymous attendee's question is what this year's March of the Flags to the old city is going to give. Will it give rise to violence, and how significant is it that it will be taking place during Ramadan? Danny, do you want to answer that question?
No, the question of what causes Jerusalem to erupt is one of the perennial questions. Jerusalem has an undeserved reputation of being nitroglycerin, that every random bump in the road will cause Jerusalem to ignite. I think that is very much overstated. I am concerned about the march. There are volatile fumes in the air, and all it takes is a spark. My tendency is to think that this particular event will be problematic, but will not cause an eruption of convulsive violence. On the other hand, I think that we are heading within a matter of weeks and months to a situation which may cause a grave conflagration in Jerusalem. Jerusalem will figure prominently in the Trump plan if and when it is released. By all indications, the inviolability of Israeli sovereignty over the old city and the Temple Mount will not be challenged. There will be a tendency, if in doubt, blame the Palestinians, as is customary. And there will be a sense that the Haram al-Sharif, the Temple Mount, is being lost to the Palestinians. That is the kind of perfect storm, when coupled with the lack of political horizon and hopelessness, that does augur for a possible outbreak of violence.
Got it.
In recent days, a senior American diplomat reached out to me precisely on this. There is concern over that. if there will be an American plan which maintains Israeli sovereignty over all of Jerusalem, or at least all of the Old City, coupled with hopelessness and coupled with a perception that Al-Aqsa is being threatened and the status quo at Al-Aqsa is being eroded, you have the potential for the outbreak of violence similar to what we witnessed in September and October of 2000.
Got it. Okay.
That is the perfect storm.
Sam Fleischacker asks...
Can I just respond to that briefly?
In two sentences. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I just say, I want to say two things. One is that I think it is absolutely horrible and offensive that they're allowing this march to go through the Muslim quarter ever, certainly this year when it falls on the Ramadan. I would say, on the other hand, though, that I sent out a letter to members of the city council asking that they join me in protesting this. And I must say, I was pleasantly surprised that many of the ultra-Orthodox came and supported me. Unfortunately, we didn't get together a majority, saying that they agreed that as religious people themselves, they were horrified and outraged and, were critical of the fact that Israel was doing this, something that is so offensive to, Muslim religious sensibilities.
Got it. Thank you very much.
There's just, there's just the fear that the gay pride parade will be in Mash Arim next year.
That was my comparison, actually.
Okay, you brought it up, so maybe I'll give a chance. Where there's the Pride Parade is supposed to be next Thursday. Laura, what's kind of going on? And there's been reports about the possibility of having the city getting the fund, pulling its funding toward the parade. Where does this issue stand?
No, there is every year. There's kind of a ritual whereby in the committee that's supposed to give the approve the funding, the ultra-Orthodox vote against, then the what ends up happening is the subject is brought before the city council, and the city council overturns the decision. That is apparently going to happen this year as well. The committee got together an ultra-Orthodox majority and voted against me and a few other city councilors. But it is going to be turned over in the city council. The mayor has come out and explicitly said he supports the activities, what's called the open house that runs this. He will see to it that the parade will take place and has been trying to be calming about this. I don't think that there is any chance now that it'll be canceled. I think all Jerusalemites recognize the fact that this is a basic fundamental demand of a legitimate part of the Jerusalem community, which is the gay community.
Got it. Okay, thank you. So Sam Fleischacker asks, what changes on the ground, if any, have you seen as a result of Trump's announcement that he's moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem and the subsequent move itself? Has that raised tensions? Danny, do you want to take that question? I'll try to keep an answer within a minute and a minute and a half.
All right. We had the dubious privilege of getting our position before Trump, even before the inauguration. We argued that if the embassy is moved, Jerusalem will be no less divided, no less binational, no less sustainable, and no less contested than it was before, and that the only thing that would be achieved is that the United States would disqualify itself as any role of broker, and that is exactly what has happened. On the ground, there has been zero impact except for a significant contribution to the hopelessness of the Palestinians. Young Palestinians cannot imagine a trajectory today whereby they will have dignity, freedom, and control of their lives. That's intangible. Tangibles, nothing has changed. Jerusalem today is more divided, less sustainable, more binational, and more contested than at any point since 1967. Thank you, Mr. Trump.
let's see. Okay. So it sounds like for Danny, the first necessary step is ending the occupation. Laura, what do you think should be the first step in achieving more justice in Jerusalem, possibly in addition to ending the occupation? Danny, is there any work to be done to move the needle in Jerusalem while also opposing the occupation?
Sorry, I didn't get that. Is that to Danny or to me?
It was to both of you. And
okay. Danny, well, to this, something? I mean, I'd say ahead, obviously, Laura. You know, we should end the occupation not only of Jerusalem. We should end the occupation of West Bank and you know, end our control over the lives of, you know, 3 million Palestinians. There's no question that that's what should happen and what will happen. I think a question is just how we're going to reach that, if it's going to be you know, if it's going to be a bloody process or not. But as far as other things that could be done, I mean, ideally what would start to happen, and it may be happening, is that gradually Israel would give more control to the Palestinians in Jerusalem. That could mean, for example, having elections for community councils. It could be, which has already happened in a couple of neighborhoods, it could be giving more control to Palestinians in running their school system, which has also happened. They have some of what's called self-management, where they get a budget and the principals decide how the money will be allocated. It could be that they will be given more independence, maybe even autonomy, in neighborhoods that have a general plan approved for dealing with their own building permits. There are a whole number of things that could be done to both allow and encourage, permit the Palestinians not only to start running their own lives in the short run, but to start creating, you know, a pre-state situation that is prepare themselves for when they will have their own city as part of their own country. So these are things that could happen that I think could be very helpful.
Okay,
and pressing to do.
Danny, I'm gonna move on to one more question just so we have more time to get to.
No problem.
So Marsha asked a question that I'm going to reword a little bit about this. These, what we've seen is quote unquote takeovers of homes in belonging to Palestinian residents in East Jerusalem by often to various groups that are national religious or Haredi, known as Elad. Where can you kind of explain? Can you comment on that, Danny? In addition, maybe touch on this notion of, I mean, a lot of people, there's one side of the coin that might kind of try to argue that these are sometimes homes, or maybe not. There are examples of homes where they used to be under Jewish control, and that they're bought, or that they're bought legally by Jewish residents. So what is the issue? Kind of maybe touch on those two comments I just made while addressing the broader issue, if you could.
Okay. Overview. There are 215,000 Israelis living in the large settlement, the neighborhoods of East Jerusalem, but there are 2,700 living in settlement enclaves, and they are driven by biblical and sometimes messianic narratives. We are on the cusp of a very significant change in that, in two specific areas. One is in Sheikh Jarrah, and the other is in Batad and Al-Hawa and so on. And it is a significant change in three ways. The settlement enclaves are enclaves because they're discontiguous with Israel. The plans afoot in both in Batan al-Hawa and in Sheikh Jarrah threaten to turn those enclaves into an extension of pre-67 Israel. That is new and that is dangerous. I've been dealing with settlements for the last 27 years. Israel has engaged in very few forceful displacement of Palestinians during that period. I know of none or maybe a handful of Palestinians who were displaced by building the large settlement neighborhoods. That is changing. Israel, the state of Israel, has instituted eviction proceedings against thousands of individuals in Sheikh Jarrah, thousands of individuals in Batan al-Hawa, the forceful displacement of a civilian population under occupation is a war crime. We haven't done it yet. We're on the cusp of doing that. And finally, what we're seeing in the uptick in these settlement activities is an indication of the ascendancy of faith communities in Jerusalem that weaponize religion. Among Jews, it is the biblically motivated settlers, the messianically driven Temple Mount movement. Among the Muslims, it's the various iterations of the Muslim Brotherhood. And among the Christians, it is the end of days evangelicals like Mike Pence who make the settlers and the Brotherhood look tame. All of these things mean that policies of settling within existing Palestinian neighborhoods has been problematic in the past. It is going to become far more problematic should current trends continue.
Thank you. So this question I'll have Laura answer.
Well, okay, unless I can say a word about that.
Give a word.
Okay. I would say that in this, actually, I agree with Daniel that it is one of the most serious, distressing changes that's been happening, that at least as it stands, it hasn't yet happened, but there seems to be a serious possibility that Israel will be removing Palestinians from their homes, evicting them, and allowing Israelis to move in their stead, which is a, if it happens, will be a terrible act. And I don't yet know how we're going to respond to it, how we, when I say the Israeli left or Israelis with conscience, which is beyond the left in the council. I just say that one other thing, which is that what is most worrisome to me about it, at least in the case of what's happened in Siwan, is that for the first time, I think the Supreme Court made some decisions that were just wrong, as far as I see it. And I'm usually a big supporter of a law and the Supreme Court. So to see Supreme Court justices supporting something that is, you know, blatantly immoral in my view is something very worrisome. We'll see if it actually, you know, proceeds and how we'll deal with that.
Okay, so Danny, let's see what I want to ask. Okay,
Danny, there's another question. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. Okay, so Danny said it just has to end. Jeffrey Wilkinson asks, it seems that even Jewish progressives want to find solutions within the Deering framework, then grasp that Israeli occupation and the injustice it fosters is impossible to fix. It has to stop, period. How do we help the left really accept this reality? A hard time kind of understanding that.
What? Should I answer that?
Go ahead, yeah.
Okay. Laura. Well, first of all, I want to say a word about something that hasn't been explicitly mentioned here, but I think it's an important subject. And that is, I want to say something about the BDS movement, which I think is terrible and wrong. And this I say as a very active leftist. I think everything should be done to protest and boycott the Netanyahu government, the right, the religious extremists, the right, the extreme right, the racists acting in Israel and so forth. I think what has been happening in many cases is that friends of mine who are active leftists have been, you know, banned, troubled, had to deal with protests just because they're Israelis, although they are the people who have the best chance of having an effect because they are here and they are, you know, appealing to the Israeli population. So that is one thing that I think shouldn't be done. How else can the Israeli left be supported? These views should be voiced. I think it should be made clear by any leftists in the U.S. who want to help us that what they're saying is, we support Israel, we oppose Israel's policy towards the West Bank, we want the occupation to end, we want East Jerusalem to look different. But it has to come from a sense that they're not against Israel and Israelis as a whole, because then they weaken us. And then what we end up having to deal with, and I end up having to deal with, is friends who are in the center saying, well, all these people are, you know, against Israel. It doesn't matter what we do because they're going to hate us anyway. There has to be a clear message that we support Israel. We support Israel's right to exist. We support democracy in Israel. We oppose what is being done now, and we want to see it change. I'll just say in a short aside that ironically and sadly, in my last trip to the States, I found finally greater understanding amongst Americans to my stance, which is you can love your country and hate the government. Trump has made this more understandable to a lot of Americans, where they say they appreciate their activities as leftists. There are a lot of good things happening in the U.S. by people who are brave and just and care about the right causes, but the current government is a disaster. As Americans say that about Trump and what's happening in the U.S. today, I say that about Israel. I love my country. I see myself as a patriot. I'm not giving up. I need people who will be with me on that abroad as well and say to me, we love Israel. We hate the government. We want to help you fix it.
Got it. Okay, Danny, I'm going to have a question for you. So we obviously, the issue of the Haram al-Sharif or the Temple Mount or whatever you want to call it, pretty much a pressure cooker kind of an issue that's very sensitive to Palestinians and Israelis. The current status quo sees a reality where where Israel pretty much controls the site, and Palestinians obviously are the ones that go and pray there. Israelis are allowed to go, but not allowed to pray themselves. How do we wind up in the reality, and why is it, do you think, is it justified that Jews aren't allowed to pray on the Temple Mount?
Well, first of all, it has been the position of every Israeli prime minister since 1967 that the Temple Mount is exclusively a place of worship for Muslims, and it is open for the dignified and respectful visits of non-Muslims, including Jews, in accordance with the decorum of the site. So when I say that I oppose Jewish prayer on the Temple Mount, which I do, I am quoting extreme left-wingers like Menachem Begin, Ariel Sharon, and Netanyahu. What we have witnessed in recent years is the transformation of a Temple Mount movement, which was a lunatic fringe in 1967, which became a fringe in the 1980s and the 1990s. It has gone mainstream. And there is, within the framework of a denial of Jewish prayer, an increasing sense among the Palestinians that their site is no longer a safe space and it is violated, and I agree with them. And the current trajectory is one of conflagration. In the past, tensions would be released when Secretary Kerry would go out, get on the phone with King Abdullah of Jordan and Netanyahu, and have the parties pull back from the brink. The United States no longer fulfills that role. In the past, a phone call would take place between Netanyahu and King Abdullah. It has been almost 2 years since King Abdullah has agreed to take a phone call from Netanyahu because of the erosion of the status quo. And we are seeing increasingly provocative visits to the Temple Mount. Unless something in the basic trajectory of events takes place, it is only a matter of time before we see an eruption of convulsive violence on Haram al-Sharif, which in the past could have been avoided.
But I want to ask you, in terms of if you talk about religious freedom, I want to push you a little bit on this. Obviously, there might be an extremist element to this in the Temple Mount movement, but just the very idea of someone being able to pray anywhere, isn't that something that should be respected?
Do you know that no Palestinian is allowed to traverse the Western Wall Plaza unless they have a special permit?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I, of course, the idea of going and looking at the other side, what it does, I'm just trying to push
There has not been a claim for a right for Jewish prayer on the Temple Mount since the 12th century. Now, we can change our mind, but our deep attachment to the Temple Mount, which I share, does not justify a change in a significant change in the status quo. Jews have not demanded rites of prayer in the Temple Mount since the 12th century. We changed our minds, but that does not bind the Muslim worshipers. They perceive Jewish prayer on the Temple Mount as a violation of the sanctity of the site, every bit as much as Jews would perceive Muslim prayer in the Western Wall Plaza. I have no difficulty empathizing with the Palestinian and the Muslim position.
Got it. Okay, thank you. I think we'll wrap up. Laura, I wish I had given you the opportunity to speak at the end. Remember what Laura had to say about the optimism, and then I'll give you a chance to say a few more words if you'd like. Danny, is there any last words that you'd like to say?
Look, I believe over time Israelis and Palestinians will settle this conflict. It will be settled in Jerusalem, and it will not be settled by gimmicks. It will be settled by a division of sovereignty in the city. I doubt I will live to see that. We are living in the period of a chasm between the politically impossible and the historically inevitable. Those of us who are pursuing a viable Israel-Palestine and a viable Jerusalem are trying to narrow the gap between the politically impossible and the historically inevitable, knowing that we will not likely live to see the results.
Got it. Laura, any last sentence or two? Or are you good?
Well, I'd just like to say, as I said, there are certainly huge problems looming, but I remain guardedly optimistic because I think, you know, if you look at the story of Solomon, right, not wanting to cut the baby in half, I think Jerusalem is important enough to all of us to not want to see it go up in flames. And I believe in and hope for the sense of responsibility amongst all of us as winning out eventually.
All right. So thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with Israel and Palestine. I want to thank I want to thank our panelists, Laura and Danny, and also thank the staff of Partners for Progressive Israel for their work in making this discussion happen. You can go to progressiveisrael.org to learn more about Partners for Progressive Israel and their future programs. Thank you and goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you.